Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority. My guest today is Robert M. Ellis, the chair of the Middle Way Society, who's been on this podcast on many occasions, and but he's here to talk to us today about his latest book, The Thought of Sangharakshita. Hello, Robert. Welcome back to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Thank you, Barry. It's great to be back.
Right, well, could you start perhaps by talking about your background in relation to Sangharakshita and what prompted you to write this particular book?
Okay, well, my personal history is of past involvement in the movement that Sangharakshita founded, which is now called Trivatna Buddhist Community, but previously was called the FWBA, or Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. So when I was 19, when I first went to university at Cambridge, I first contacted Buddhists in that movement. So my introduction to Buddhism and lots of Buddhist ideas really came from them, through that movement. So I went on then at that time to join a community and for a short time to work in a business run by them. Then I left that for a while and came back to it in the mid-90s. I did have my various doubts and hesitations at that point even. But from the mid-90s up until the noughties, so up till 2008, I was involved in the sort of main phase, my involvement with that movement. That culminated in me being ordained into the Western Buddhist Order, as it was then called, between 2004 and 2008 when I left it. So obviously, all that period of my life had a big effect and shaped me in many ways. And that movement was founded by Sangharakshita, and he's behind a lot of the ideas and practices and the way to approach these things. One thing I recognised, the more I thought about this and the more I reflected on it as time went by, is how much my own understanding of the Middle Way and of things I've written about in my books is influenced by Sangharakshita. Even though a lot of what he says about it is patchy in many ways. It was kind of an overdue process in some ways for me to go back to his work and look at it more seriously. Well, I did look at it before, but not quite in the same way. To look at it critically and seriously, and but being under no pressure at all to accept things that I wasn't willing to accept. As I did feel that I was, you know, when I was in the movement itself. And I think having got past the reactive phase, you know, so this was getting on for 10 years after I'd left the order. So my experience is that I was no longer settling old scores or anything of that kind. It wasn't about bitter grapes or criticizing Sangharakshita in any way. So my motives were partly about, for myself, finding a balanced, critical understanding of Sangharakshita's views that influenced me so much. And also, I felt that could very well be a useful process to share with other people through a book, particularly people who have been influenced by Sangharakshita, as I have, or people who are still, there are many, many people who are still involved in Trivatna but have their doubts and their hesitations and could do with sort of more of an outside view on it or more of a critical view on it. So I felt the book might be helpful for those sorts of people particularly. And yeah, it's also an application of the middle way. So I was trying to, in a way, demonstrate what it would mean to apply the middle way as thoroughly as I could, in as balanced a way as I could, to a single figure. So it's a kind of case study, if you like, of a particular figure who is, you know, very creative, very interesting figure in many ways, but also controversial and, as I say, patchy. So to try and sort all that out requires, you know, many aspects of the middle way, really, but yeah, the even-handed assessment, which is what I tried to do, yeah, that has its emotional aspects. You need to approach it in the right way emotionally, as well as having a critical sense of the philosophical starting points. I mean, one of the things particularly I wanted to point out about Sangharakshita is how varied, in a way, his starting assumptions are and how inconsistent they are. I wanted to sort of track those down and see where he was coming from at different points.
Okay. Well, could you give us an overview of the book?
Basically, it starts with an introduction, just giving explanation of why, the kind of thing I've just been saying about why I wrote the book, and also a little bit about his life, but it's not a biography, but a little bit of biographical information is helpful. So maybe I could say a bit more about that in a minute. The main part of the book is looking at a range of Sangharakshita's ideas. They were practical ideas, so they're ideas and practices in a way. So ideas that he put into practice in most cases. It moves really from the positive to the negative, although there's a mixture all the way through in some ways. So it starts with the views that I think had the most positive and innovative kind of effect. These were really ways in which he took aspects of Western tradition and interpreted them in ways that were compatible with Buddhism. So he helped in a way to interpret Buddhism for Westerners in new ways. In the process, obviously, he brought Western and Buddhist ideas into contact with each other in creative and synthetic ways. So I start with that kind of thing, and then I move on to the sort of more neutral territory. So where there is a fairly more even mixture of, you know, his attitude to meditation, for example, or friendship, or and then there's his treatment of Buddhist doctrines, where we start getting into perhaps a greater incidence of dogmatic assumptions. And then the final section is the controversies. So the bits that have really caused people problems, including his, particularly his attitudes to sex and gender, but also his assumptions about his authority and the use of his image. So those controversial areas I left to the end because I wanted to contextualize them as much as possible, so that people would understand them in the whole context of, well, the assumptions he made at various points, how some of them worked and others didn't, and that really the practical issues that emerged like that were at least partly due to those assumptions, and can be traced back to them. So hopefully by the time you get to the stuff about sex scandals, then you can see why that's deserving of a bigger context. Why he wasn't just the guy who had the sex scandals. He was, you know, a much bigger figure who's interesting in lots of other ways. So it's obviously I wrote the book in the context of a very polarized discussion. So you can find trenchant defenders of Sangharakshita, and you find people who immediately dismiss everything he said or did, because well, the word abuser comes up a lot, you know, so because they regard him as an abuser, and that vitiates everything he said for them. So you get those two extremes, and so a lot of what I was trying to do through that build-up from the better to the worse, if you like, from the less controversial to the more controversial, is to put that debate in a context so as to build up sort of maximum possibility for people to be able to overcome those polarized
decisions. What might be useful, Robert, is obviously we can only get a snapshot of the book here, but in the first section where you highlight the more positive sides of his work, what for you particularly stands out, or what for you particularly inspires you about his work?
Well, certainly the ways in which he did at times use the middle way, and I mean, he kind of in a way highlighted the middle way, or at least stimulated it in the practice of the movement he founded, in that you do often find middle way judgments going on, whether they're explicit or not, in the way that people tackle things. And that seems to me to be true at its best, where people do use it. And so there are points where Sangha actually uses it quite explicitly. There's a talk he gave called 20 Years on the Middle Way, where he applies the middle way to a variety of issues and shows how the way that the movement had advised people and guided people was following the middle way. That for example, in attitudes to parents, so supposing you've joined this new Buddhist movement and your parents are very suspicious, which is a common scenario. So one extreme would be to just cut off your relationship with your parents. And so it's like joining a cult, isn't it? One of the symptoms of a cult is that people cut off other relationships. But the other extreme would be obviously not to fully engage with and not to fully learn from your new context because you were still obeying your parents in some sense, or too much under their authority. So his middle way approach generally was, yeah, you know, you do need to stay in touch with your parents and keep in as good communication with them as you can, but that doesn't mean that you have to take their advice or be ruled by them. You know, you perhaps need to be decisive. Supposing you want to move into a community and do something that your parents disapprove of, you know, that should be okay. So that's just an example, but he, you know, that kind of practical advice does come through at times, and it also emerged in the way that Trivatna at its best, you know, conducted itself and still does. That sort of advised balance, if you like. So he wrote in that vein at times, but he didn't always stick to it, and a lot of the time he also appeared to forget about it. Actually, this is in one of the previous podcasts where I interviewed Sangha Rakshita. I forget what number it is now, but it's a few dozen back now, I think, from what this one will be. But I asked him about the application of the middle way in his view of Buddhist ethics, and he said, "Well, I didn't think about it very much in relation to ethics." And I said, "Well, do you think you should have done?" And he said, "Well, yeah, maybe I should." So there's this big gap. He wrote a lot about Buddhist ethics. You know, he wrote a book called The Ten Pillars, which is really quite a good book about ethics. Nothing about the middle way, you know, use of that whole perspective, which is really important in Buddhism. It's not as though he didn't know about it. So that's the, I mean, I'm inspired by, yeah, that's just an example of what I'm inspired by at times in both the theory and the practice, and then also dismayed by the inconsistency.
It seems quite a feat of organisation to actually start an order which has had such influence and, you know, and has stuck around. Did he do it largely single-handed? What was it that, you know, enabled it to gain traction? Was it his writing? Was he out there? Did he have a kind of ministry? How did he set it all up? I'm just curious.
Well, he returned to England after 20 years in India, which he's a Buddhist monk working in India. No, he was originally English, came from Tooting. And then he was working with the English Sangha Trust, which is a more traditional kind of Theravada outfit, but got into conflict with them. And because he was experimenting, it seems, with new ways of approaching Buddhism and presenting it. So he then decided to found his own movement, which certainly in the early years, he does seem to have carried a lot of it. So he taught all the classes and ran it. But he was also quite good at passing on responsibility. So I think as soon as he could, he passed things on to disciples. And there was one occasion where he famously just went away for a retreat for several months in a caravan somewhere in Cornwall, I think it was, and left people to it to see how they'd get on without him. And they were then forced to find their own ways of doing things. So he had obviously had quite a strong sense of needing not to carry everything and to help other people mature in their own way.
Okay, and to what degree would you say now the organization of Triyatna is, you know, is an integrative organization? How balanced, how well do they apply the middle way in general as an organization, both as a, you know, on a larger the organization itself and as for the individuals within it?
Well, there are lots of integrative good things going on, I think. You know, perhaps the biggest is that you know, thousands and thousands of people have learned to meditate and done so pretty well in Triyatna. That's what I learned to meditate. There's you know, the stress on friendship and community is really helpful to people. You know, there's also quite a big sense of a range of practices and how they all knit together. So the Eightfold Path and how the different elements of the Eightfold Path depend on each other. So there is study and discussion, there is ritual, which at least the idea is to fire the imagination. There is a lot of engagement with the arts, and so on. Yeah, overall, there's a lot of integrative practice going on.
Would you say there are any, from your, in your opinion, entrenched dogmas within the organisation?
Yeah, so that's the but. So I think there are things that should continue to impede it, as far as I can see. And a lot of those are to do with inconsistencies in Sangharakshita's own teachings and ways of approaching things. So, I mean, the institution of the order is one question, because although the order is, it's a much more sort of flexible way of doing things than traditional Buddhist monasticism, where some people get ordained, but they're not monks or nuns, they're committed, it's a commitment. But it's still a discontinuous kind of social recognition of that commitment, and it doesn't take into account what I call asymmetry of integration, really. So the fact that people can be terribly lopsided in the way that they develop. Yeah. So there is this, you know, I experienced this when I was ordained, that you, suddenly people are trusting you in ways that you weren't trusted before, and that seems weird, because, you know, I haven't changed that much. I've just gone through this ceremony, and I've got this funny name. Which rapidly becomes a burden. So there's various kind of conventions, which seem to have rigidified a bit, which often get in the way, I think. So there's various things adopted from Buddhist culture, like the names, really. I think, you know, my own view increasingly is that they're a barrier more than anything else, from direct experience, anyway. There also is an inconsistency of the underlying philosophical appeal. You know, so people can come up with views, and you don't really know where those views are going to come from, because Sangha Akshita at various points was motivated by the middle way sometimes, by practical considerations at times, but also by traditional Buddhist dogmas. So he didn't let go of things like the Buddha had to be enlightened and you needed to believe that the Buddha was enlightened to be a Buddhist. He didn't let go of the law of karma. He had to try and make things like that work in relation to the modern situation. Just the attitude that you have to do that, actually. So very often people in Trivatana are still trying to do that, I think, because that's what he tried to do. They're still trying to make absolutizations fit rather than having the courage to say, well, actually, this doesn't work. We need to let go of this, which I think is really necessary with some things.
Okay.
So it comes down to, yes, the influence of absolute beliefs, some of them Buddhist, some of them Platonic, as well as this Platonism in Sangha Akshita's thinking that has side effects as well.
And the organization now since his death, how is that, faring? Is it in a state of flux? Is it, do many people see that as an opportunity for it to go off in a different direction? Is it flourishing, what would you say? How is it faring?
I'm probably not the best person to ask this, really, because I do get a sense, obviously, from my contacts in the order from how things are going, but I don't have a strong sense of what the direction is since his death. I'm not sure if one has emerged yet, really.
Yeah, okay. Okay, well, can we have a look now at the more controversial side of Sangha Akshita? I mean, and for the listeners who are not very familiar with him as a person, could you just give us an outline is there one controversy, or is it a more wider ranging?
There are several which I tackle in the last section of the book. Though I have to say, I tackle them more in a philosophical way. So I tackle them more in what were the underlying assumptions that were made here, even in practice, rather than forensically, so what happened in this incident or whatever, who was at fault or whatever. So the general issues which I mentioned earlier include things like his authority over the order. So there's a basic question of should the order be following him, which is kind of the traditional pattern that the order follows what the founder said it should be, or should it regulate itself? Because it's a different kind of order. I don't get the impression that's been resolved at all. And then there's the issue that anyone who certainly until recently, anyway, somebody who goes into a Trivatana center, and one of the things you'll find is Sangha Akshita's picture on the shrine. You'd probably be beneath the Buddha, not level with the Buddha, but there's the effect of that, maybe, and that particularly I think that people feel that they ought to venerate him, and the ways in which that might lead people to treat him critically. Those are quite important issues, I think, but the ones that tend to come more to the fore are about gender and about sexual behaviour and about the family.
About what, sorry?
And about the family and marriage. And that there's also the single sex idea, single sex principle, which is controversial for some people. For me, it's not the biggest controversy, but the fact that a lot of True Batman's activities are single sex based. But certainly the claim is that this is experimental and it's just based on experience of it working better. To a large extent, I think that's probably correct, but the jury's out as far as I'm concerned as to how well it works. It's not all that clear. The obvious big thing is the allegations of sexual abuse with young men. So that's the thing which has caused the greatest polarization. So there were about at least 20 to 25 relationships that he had with younger men when he was, he was in this position of being the authoritative teacher, he was gay. I mean, this is obviously one of the interesting and complicated things about Sangharakshita, that he's quite traditionalist and quite conservative in some ways, but also obviously into gay rights and making that part of Buddhism. And also into the value of promiscuous relationships. So one other sort of dogma that creeps in, I think, is a kind of 60s dogma that it's better to be non-attached by having promiscuous relationships, and that monogamous relationships are likely to be neurotic. So although he's on the surface not absolute about that, he says, oh, of course there can be neurotic promiscuity and healthy monogamy as well, but he's very likely to focus on the drawbacks of monogamous relationships, and I think to idealize promiscuous relationships. So he had these promiscuous relationships with young men, and he seemed to be very blind to the issues of consent, really. So if you're 50s, 60s, whatever, and you're big authoritative teacher and you're having sex with an 18, 20 year old, that raises big issues of consent for us today.
And not just consent, of abuse of power as well.
Yeah, indeed, yeah, that's part of it. Yeah. So a lot of the time he just didn't seem to be aware of that. There's a sort of, people described it as a blind spot. So it's hard to see it as malicious in any way, obviously, but some major mistakes need to be made, and there were some people who have, to varying extents, been badly affected by their experience with him or felt abused by him, some of whom have had psychological issues with that later. So that's what's caused all the biggest controversy.
You said allegations, but wasn't there one point that he actually apologised near the end of his life? So there was some
apology. Yeah, he apologised in quite a general way. Yeah, it was a very generalised apology that he apologised for any ways in which he'd hurt fellow Buddhists. So that there wasn't any attempt really to go through individual issues and acknowledge where specific individuals had been harmed by his actions.
Yeah. Just thinking.
Indeed to look at the assumptions that led to that. I think that's the more important aspect of it.
Yeah, I'm just playing devil's advocate here, Robert, but I'm just imagining to get a sense of the anger that a lot of people feel, and are potentially the anger, especially the people who were subject to the abuse, that someone might have done some good works or come out some good ideas, that they nevertheless forfeit the right for a platform for that because of the suffering they've caused. I'm just thinking, I'm not putting Sangharakshita in the same league as Jimmy Savile or Paul Gadd, I could Gary Glitter, but I think Jimmy Savile raised £400 million of for charity, and you know, Gary Glitter arguably made some catchy songs, but he's never played on the radio, and that's you know, because well, perhaps for two reasons, partly because you know, people feel he's forfeited that right to have a wider audience, but also because of the concern for the victims of the abuse that they've caused. So I was just thinking, you know, say your book became successful, and you know, Sangharakshita was lauded for the positive things that the book has brought out, and some of the victims of his, if I could use the word victim, or of his abuse, saw that that might, you know, that could potentially be traumatic for them. So I just wondered what your thoughts are on that. I'm making the point that I'm not putting in the same league as those two people I mentioned, but nevertheless, there's a spectrum there.
That's the whole point. There's a spectrum there. And that's what people have great difficulty with, experience, that to see it as a spectrum. That, I mean, to compare him to Savile, you know, he didn't break the law as far as I can see, or there's no clear evidence that he did, although there's some discussion about that. But he wasn't abusing children, legally speaking. You could use the term abuser, but again, that's a very loaded term, which tends to lead people away from an incremental view of the issue towards a polarised one. What I'm trying to do in the book is not at all to explain away what he did or apologise for it, but to try and at least investigate the philosophical or ideological assumptions that supported it. Which, as I said, well, they largely, I think, one's about authority, assumptions about his authority, unquestionable authority in some ways, and assumptions about promiscuity, the way he idealised promiscuity. So hopefully that can contribute to helping to explain the conditions that gave rise to that situation. And if people can understand that a bit better, maybe that will help them to put things in a bit more context. And obviously I can't take responsibility for other people's polarised reactions. There will still be people who have polarised reactions either way when you genuinely try to apply them in a way to a polarised debate. You know, so there will still be some people who effectively think Sangharakshita is a saint and that he's been, you know, entirely accused wrongly, and there'll be other people who think he's just the devil incarnate. But one has to make a good go, I think, of trying to contextualise it and at least maximise the chances that anyone who reads the book will be able to see those events in context. They're not excusable, but they're really a very small part in context of everything he did and the effects it had on people. And also another issue I discuss is how far this, if at all, this was institutionalised. And I think that's would have been a much more concerning thing if there'd been a culture of abuse, which was then like to continue in Trivatna, which was enshrined in its teachings. But I really didn't find any evidence of that. There's a few isolated examples of other world members saying things which are quoted by the critics, obviously. But they're very out of context. There's very little evidence that this is systematically part of the way that Trivatna approaches things. So I think, I don't have any problem with, you know, if someone wants to go and learn to meditate in a Trivatna centre, I'm not going to warn them, you know, you might encounter abuse or something, because that's really very unlikely. I think they'd be very confident of that.
Okay. And is there anything you'd like to add, Robert, before we end?
Okay, well, obviously there are lots of aspects of the book I haven't talked much about, but the more positive stuff near the beginning does look at some of the other key ways that Sangha actually used Western ideas and related them to Buddhism. So ideas about integration, and provisionality and individuality. So all of those ideas, I think, fed in importantly to the way that Truanna developed and have also influenced me. And they connect with aspects of Western culture, so psychology and democracy and science, scientific method. So I'm trying to give sort of full credit to those aspects of his work. But also, again, I haven't said very much about the dogmas, really. So there's a lot of strange. Just to give you another example, the Platonic dogmas which applied to his views, which it seems clear he did hold until his death, about the superior spiritual aptitude of men over women. So applying a Platonic belief that if you were more biological, you would have lower spiritual aptitude. So if you're more ruled by biological urges, yeah, that's basically the reasoning. And he felt that it was clear that women were more kind of slaves to biology because of childbirth and the effects of childbirth. So therefore, men were closer to angels than women. So one of his major followers, Subhuti, wrote a book about this called Women, Men and Angels, which caused a huge controversy in the movement and was then withdrawn and pulped by Subhuti. But Sangharakshita continued to believe in those things and objected to the fact that the book had been withdrawn. So he was also, he's a tremendously creative and synthetic thinker, and he was also a stubborn old man who wouldn't admit that he was wrong about fundamental issues, which had a very negative effect on the people in his movement. You know, not just the sex abuse stuff, but also basic stuff about the role of women in the movement. There are lots of other examples like that I could give of pretty weird dogmas that creep into his teaching. So you've just got to be on your guard and think critically. Yeah. If people can do that, which is quite difficult, I know, really, yeah, a lot of people, but if people can do that, then they can get a lot out of his writings. But obviously, you can't just swallow it wholesale.
Yes, the whole caboodle. Yeah. Well, sounds fascinating, Robert. Sounds very interesting depiction of a very complex, inspiring at times, but also very flawed human being.
Yeah.
And also a very interesting exercise in even-handedness. Anyway, I wish you every success with the book, Robert, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you. Yes, I mean, I hope I've been up to the challenge of even-handedness, but at least I can say I've tried. Yeah. And I seem to be the first person to have tried doing this, so at least, you know, it's something to have had a go.
Oh, well, good for you. You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.